This is the What Matters Most podcast. A 100% listener-supported program. And now, here is your host, Paul Samuel Dolman.
Welcome back to What Matters Most, my wonderful audience all over the world. Thank you for tuning in, sharing your affirmations, your ideas, the Patreons who support the show, for the dialogues, the contemplations. I really appreciate this family that we've created over about 8 years now. Today, I have really one of the best minds, one of my favorite journalists, authors, Pulitzer Prize winner. He wrote a book called Perfectly Legal, which opened my eyes to the tax system in America. He also wrote the book, The Making of Donald Trump, which was sort of like the origin story of this Frankenstein. And now he has an incredible new book called The Big Cheat, How Donald Trump Fleeced America and Enriched Himself and His Family. Just a masterpiece. I couldn't put it down. It's such an honor to welcome back to the family, Mr. David K. Johnston. Thanks for coming on.
Well, Paul, thank you for having me on.
I was thinking, too, reading you through the years, that you've kind of got the dubious distinction now of being an authority on this longtime criminal.
Well, I've been covering Donald longer than anyone else, more than 33 years. He was one of several people I identified at various points that I believed would be very important going forward. Daryl Gates, the LAPD chief, who I covered for the LA Times until the paper shut me down in the early 80s and exposed all the LAPD nonsense about what a great police department it was. Baron Hilton, the hotelier, who schemed to steal almost two-thirds of $1 billion from the mouths of starving children. And Jack Welch, the head of General Electric, who in many ways ruined that great company, and who ultimately, after I wrote a piece explaining the economics of his retirement package, gave up benefits that I figure were worth in the neighborhood of $70 million because they contradicted his stated principles and outraged all sorts of people once they understood them. Donald was somebody, when I met him in 1988, I went, this guy is going to be an important cultural force in America.
Did you have any idea, though, that he would rise to the rank of president of the United States?
Well, Donald has talked about why he should be president since at least 1987. And one of the first things I wrote about him, it's in my first book, Temples of Chance, which came out in 1992 and was about how America Incorporated had taken over the casino business from Murder Incorporated, includes a scene where Donald took the ship he leased that he called the Trump Princess from New York to Atlantic City, the only time he ever went anywhere on that ship. And he gets off at the Trump Castle Casino, which is in the marina in Atlantic City. And people are literally screaming for him. And a man shouts out, Donald, be our president. So I've known that he has this ambition and desire. And in 2015, when he made his latest announcement that he was running, I dropped everything I was doing, Paul, to focus on him. And the reason was, in 2012, he had said he was running for president. All the politics reporters on a national level treated him as a serious candidate. Lawrence O'Donnell of MSNBC and I independently understood that he was actually running for a new contract with NBC for his quote-unquote reality show. And indeed, once he got it, he announced, well, you know, I really should be president. No one else is qualified. America needs me, but right now my TV show needs me more. And so the politics reporters all had egg on their face. And I knew that they would treat him as a joke and a vanity project. And I tried very hard to get everyone I knew in journalism, including my former editors at the New York Times, to understand what he was doing. And I was just dismissed as, oh, is this a vanity project? Donald's crazy, et cetera. And particularly the view at the New York Times that everybody knows he's a crook, which I told them, no, everybody in Manhattan knows that. But people in Keokuk, Iowa, and and Oklahoma, who only know him from his faux reality show, think he's a business genius and a great American.
And I remember you writing about him in those Atlantic City days, that he had no idea what he was doing with the casino business and probably would go broke, which did happen.
Yeah, his own managers and executives were among my best sources, along with his competitors. When I arrived in Atlantic City, I knew that Trump was an important part of the story because the rest of the casinos were owned basically by corporations with a bunch of dull, you know, executives. And I was surprised, I think the second or third day I was there, I talked to the owner of a competing casino called the Sands. And he says to me, I don't know anything about the business. I don't know a damn thing about it, the casino business. And I was, reasonably disbelieving. The man owned two casinos. Why wouldn't he know the business? And the first business day I was there, Monday, I went and met with regulators. And the mantra in New Jersey, Paul, was that casinos were the most highly regulated industry in the history of the world, which I proceeded to show was nonsense. So heavily insulated that I named 12, 13, and 14-year-old children who gambled and were given liquor and limousines and suites by some of the casinos, including Donald's. And the regulators said, Donald, I'd say, well, how does he run his casinos? Donald is not an operator. Well, what does that mean? Donald is not an operator. Donald is not an operator. They wouldn't budge from this line, at least initially, till they got to know me well. And then I went to his executives and they said, oh, Donald doesn't know anything about running the casino business and he interferes all the time and we'd be making a lot more money if he didn't keep interfering. And my book, Temples of Chance, opens with the biggest gambler in the world, and I'm the only journalist who ever watched him gamble, Akio Kashiwagi, betting at Trump Plaza in Atlantic City at the rate of $14 million an hour. And Donald is winning. It's 4 o'clock in the morning, and Donald stands to make $24 million off this guy, and he interferes in the game. And the guy uses an excuse to walk away, and Donald lost $6 million because he owed money. And at the time, I was floored that a couple of casino publications reviewed the book or wrote about it in a way suggesting I didn't understand the numbers of how the game of Baccarat works. And of course, I understood them perfectly. It's the reason I used the opening example I did. And I realized later, as was told to me by somebody else in journalism who covers casinos, they couldn't pick a fight with Donald. So they had to find some way to defend him and attack me because his advertising buying was important to the publications that mischaracterized what I wrote. And I saw in that way back then, Paul, this is the book came out in 1992, how once you get away from the major news organizations, he used his advertising buys to influence what they did. And in the case of the major news organizations, they regarded him as, entertaining fun. Even the New York Times sort of treated him as, they wrote some tough pieces about him, but it was sort of, here's this crazy New York person. They didn't, as Wayne Barrett of The Village Voice and I and one other journalist who was at the Wall Street Journal at the time did, and that was to recognize the guy was a white-collar criminal and really dig into things and show that things he said were provably false, easily provably false. Of course, Donald was taught by his second father, as he called him, the notorious lawyer Roy Cohn, that if anyone challenges you, especially law enforcement, they're corrupt, they're dishonest. You are as pure as the driven snow. And even if something is patently obvious, deny, 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 attack, attack, attack. And if you're prosecuted or facing that prospect, delay, delay, delay. That's what got him to the White House. He is a master con artist. He is the most successful con artist in the history of the world. He conned his way all the way to the White House.
Brilliant. And I'm glad you mentioned Roy Cohn because his whole life is really an example. I see Roy's fingerprints all over it. We're actually taping this on the 6th of January, 1 year from what happened at the Capitol, which I still can't believe, even though I watched it live. First, what went through your mind and your heart? And here you have all this journalism experience, life experience. David, what were you feeling as you watched that riot, that coup, that violence unfold in front of you?
Well, anyone who watched Donald's remarks before the attack on the Capitol began should have understood clearly that he was telling his followers to go and attack the Capitol and attack Congress. He said he was going to go with them, and then he went the opposite direction to the White House. And the single most revealing thing that occurred in public that day was at the Capitol, the Secret Service, hearing hang Mike Pence, kill Nancy Pelosi, grabs Pence and the Capitol security grabs Pelosi, and they get them out of there to safety. And at the White House, nothing is going on in terms of security. We've all seen dramatic presentations of what the Secret Service does if there's a real threat to the president. A bunch of big guys come into the room and they literally pick him up off his feet and run him down the hall to a secure area in the deeper floors of the White House, which are very, very deep. Nothing happened. And we learned very quickly that Donald was watching this on TV and saying to people, hey, come watch this. Isn't this great? Wow, this is terrific. Well, people like Ivanka and Sean Hannity are trying in various ways to say, you know, you got to stop this. This is not good. To Donald, this was great. And I'm very surprised, frankly, that no member of Congress was killed, that no police officer was killed. Donald, of course, and people like Tucker Carlson continue to argue that Ashley Babbitt, one of the people breaking into the Capitol, was murdered. No, a police officer made the decision in the split second that he had, or the few seconds he had, as she tried to enter the Capitol by breaking through, knowing there were members of Congress who, if they got through that door, they would get and would probably kill. They announced they were planning to kill people. He shot her, which backed them all off and gave the members of Congress time to get away. But the lying about this by Fox News that continues until today, the denigration of what actually happened. Last night, January 5th, about how Tucker Carlson opened his show mocking people who see January 6th as an insurrection or a coup. He called it a riot and a protest, and said, oh, you know, when it's the reporters, you know, they're living in terror. When they close their eyes at night, they see the cannons hitting the Capitol and the bodies being blown apart. And, oh, it's just terrible. And then he says, oh, I got to stop this. It's mocking them like this is just too much. But that's exactly what he was doing. And Fox News has been working very hard to sell the idea that, hey, this was just a protest. It's no different than any other. No, it was not. This was a serious effort. What weeks of planning went into it, money went into it, which is what I'm really interested most in seeing come out, to finance this effort to overthrow the government. And there was a plan developed by John Eastman, the disgraced former dean of the Chapman University Law School in Orange, California, where when I was a boy, I lived on a farm in the town of Orange. We were Orange ranchers. Wrote this plan for how to overturn the election. And some years ago at Syracuse University College of Law, where I am a member of the faculty, I'm not a lawyer, but I've taught there for many years. He and I debated, and the Federalist Society students who invited John Eastman and persuaded me to come to this debate, I think some full professor had backed out of it. I'm merely a lecturer, a distinguished visiting lecturer. Eastman, it was clear at the end of the debate, was a lightweight and an ideologue who hadn't prepared for the debate. And one of the Federalist students literally said to me, man, you wiped the floor with that guy. Because that's who surrounds it. I mean, no serious person of decent intent wants anything to do with Donald. So he surrounds himself with people, some of whom are very smart. I mean, John Eastman is a smart guy. Steve Bannon is a smart guy. Mark Meadows appears to be, certainly Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, is a smart guy. But none of those are people who have records indicating that they are public servants, that they're dedicated to making our democracy endure and, as our Constitution promises, to create a more perfect union.
Isn't it shocking, too, the level of planning, the memos? They literally had a PowerPoint presentation. And when you talk about the financing, Ginny Thomas, the wife of Clarence Thomas, the Supreme Court Justice, is one of the people that put money into it, along with many other deep-pocketed people. This thing was not spontaneous, and it was well-planned, and the Willard, too, is a big deal.
It was not at all. Donald called the quote-unquote war room at the Willard Hotel a few blocks from the White House to talk to Bannon and Eastman and others who were plotting to overthrow the government, which shows you that this is a conspiracy under federal law, and I think more than warrants charges of seditious conspiracy. That's what was brought against the 14 Puerto Rican nationalists who in, I think it was March of 1953, fired shots inside the House chamber because they wanted to free Puerto Rico. And they got sentences of up to 75 years for what they did for seditious conspiracy. And I think that should happen to Donald. That, of course, is not what the big cheat is about. The big cheat is about how Donald tried to turn the Oval Office into an ATM to loot the Treasury on behalf of himself, his family, and his cronies.
I'm going to start with the book in a second. I just wondered, are you surprised that there have been no consequences of real record or authority so far, 1 year after all this happened, that the planners, the financiers, the people at the Willard, Donald himself, Ivanka, Jared, you name it, nothing, no consequences?
I think that Nancy Pelosi was very slow to create the January 6th committee. Part of that is because the Republicans made all sorts of demands, and she gave into every single demand the Republicans had: equal number of Democrats and Republicans, equal budget, equal subpoena power, et cetera. And then Kevin McCarthy walked away and began denouncing it. That's why there are only two Republicans on that committee. Merrick Garland, our attorney general, in a speech on the 5th, gave the impression that they are working on moving up the chain from the bottom to higher level people without naming anyone. That's a standard law enforcement technique. On the other hand, at this point, if they had a grand jury going or were actively investigating Trump or his chief of staff Meadows or people like that, something would have come out by now. Prosecutors never leak. I've never gotten a leak from a prosecutor in a grand jury proceeding in my life. The leaks come from defense lawyers and ancillary people, often, you know, hey, I got this tip for you, and they're client was a witness to the grand jury or may become a witness. Those are the people who leak. And nothing like that's happened. There hasn't been a search warrant put in the public record. There haven't been FBI agents who raided somebody's house in a way that would suggest that they're pursuing such a case. And well, it may be difficult for someone like Merrick Garland to decide to prosecute a former president. That can open up a can of political worms we may regret. I can't think of anyone in the United States more richly deserving of indictment than Donald Trump, whose oath of office was to uphold and defend the Constitution, but whose actions make it absolutely crystal clear he sought to destroy our Constitution. And as I warned people way back in 2015, he would never leave the White House peacefully if he got there, and he would try to become our dictator for life, which is exactly what the record shows he did.
Do you think he'll run again, David, in 2024? I bet money he'll fundraise because he can keep the cash and those people will send him money. But do you think he'll actually run and try to get elected again?
Well, he's very actively fundraising. He's raised at least $250 million, and I expect he'll end up at somewhere north of $500 million. That's his new job. He's America's beggar in chief. But somewhere between now and the 2024 election, Trump is going to be indicted. The Manhattan grand jury will indict him for sure. They haven't yet because they expected to get 1 million documents from his accountants and they got 5 million and they have to go through all of those documents. He's likely to be indicted in Westchester County, a New York suburb, for property tax evasion and fraud and bank fraud, perhaps, and a very important law in New York State involving business records. New York is such a business center that has a very tough law on fraudulent business records. And he may get indicted in Fulton County, Georgia, which is essentially overlays Atlanta, for election fraud, and possibly by the Attorney General of Washington, D.C., over what happened to the inaugural money. There's a chapter in my book about how there's very good reason to believe that the $107 million of inaugural donations they reported wasn't all the money they took in, because they tried to get someone involved in a criminal conspiracy to take in money off the books.
Yeah, and she wrote a book about it.
Yes, and I wrote a chapter about her that's a lot more focused and clear about what happened.
Oh, God, you made my day saying he's going to get indicted. I wonder if he'll ever do time, but that would still be a big thing. How has this human being avoided consequences his entire life? Is it just the Roy Cohen playbook?
Yeah, it's Donald is the third generation head of a four generation white collar crime family. These are not people who break your leg or kill you. They steal from you with promises, unpaid bills. You know, you deliver services or work, and then they refuse to pay you and say, sue me. And you know, it started with his grandfather, who lied to get his American citizenship after he fled Germany in 1885 to avoid the draft. A lot of young men did that in 1885 when they turned 16 or during that era, came to America because you got drafted into Bismarck's army. You could be there till you were too old to be a soldier. I think the record is quite clear that he ran whorehouses in Seattle, Everett, Washington, and the Yukon Territory. He even built a hotel on land he didn't own, but this was not a hotel for sleeping. It was for what in the day were called sporting ladies. And his father ripped off the taxpayers after World War II for, in today's money, roughly $40 million. And when President Eisenhower was told about this, and remember, Eisenhower's the guy who had to send, what was it, more than 9,000 men to their deaths on the beaches of France. I mean, what a terrible moral burden to carry with you. And Eisenhower, when he was told what Fred Trump had done, threw a fit. He was spitting angry because here was a program to help the survivors of World War II, soldiers and sailors, be able to get decent housing, and Fred Trump ripped it off. And Donald followed in the footsteps of his father, who, by the way, had a business partner. Fred Trump's business partner was a man named Willie Tomasello, and there are extensive reports of New York State organized crime commissions and police reports that Willie Tomasello was a front for the Gambino and Genovese crime families, the two most important, vicious, and powerful crime families, mafia families in New York City.
He obviously comes by his illegal activity honestly in a bit of a strange turn of the
phrase. Yes, it's one of the great ironies here is, And you know, when some people will say, well, you know, Donald had to do business with the mob because that's the real estate business. Well, the true story is that when big developers, Donald was never a big developer, even though he claims he was the biggest. When big developers went to the FBI and the U.S. Justice Department and said, you got to get these mobsters out of our pockets. We just can't do business in New York. This was in the late 70s. Donald ran the other direction. He ran straight to the mobsters. So when there was a concrete strike, and every delivery to New York City came to a stop because the Teamsters and the Concrete Workers Union were controlled by the mob, and a lot of the concrete was controlled by the mob. Every project in New York stopped. You know, you were having a new driveway poured, tough luck, except at one location, Trump Tower, which is a concrete high rise, 58 stories of concrete. It's not a steel girder skyscraper.
I can say for the record, too, I have countless friends who are developers, real developers, billionaires in New York, people that ran all kinds of businesses it's common knowledge that everybody has to assume to get paid, and more than once. And I know people personally have shown me the paperwork. I mean, doesn't pay his bills, whether it's $2,000 carpet bill or a $2 million something other bill. I mean, it's just he's the epitome of a deadbeat.
Yeah. There was a guy he hired to do some graphic design who went to the office, gives him large pieces of printed paper that have the design material he wants. And Donald looks at him, puts him behind his desk and says, "This is crap. I'm not going to pay you for it. It isn't what I ordered." The guy said, "Fine, give it back to me." He said, "I'm not going to give it back to you. I'm going to use it, but it's crap." And the cost would have been in the neighborhood of 10 times the value of the contract. Now, there is one contractor who sued Donald, the owner of a Benjamin Moore paint franchise in Miami. Donald refused to pay him the last $35,000. And this went up and down the courts again and again and again, running up the guy's legal bills. He was cheated out of, as I recall, $35,000, but he was not going to give in. And finally, the judge, tired of all the Trump appeals, ordered Trump's designated witness to appear in court. And he said, "Why isn't this bill paid?" And the manager of the Doral said, "Mr. Trump feels that he's paid enough." Imagine if you're an employee and your company said, "You know, we think we paid you enough through Wednesday this week, so we're not going to pay you in full." Or you said to the car dealer you bought a car from, "Well, I've paid you 2/3 of the money. I think that's enough." I mean, that's not how the system works. And the judge immediately ordered payment. That's how Donald works. And when he got into the White House, they began setting up these schemes. Now, people who've read the book, you know, some of them people know about here or there. It depends on what news media you were reading. You may know the story that appeared in the Washington Post or the one that the LA Times broke, but nobody's comprehensively drawn all these loose threads together until my book, The Big Cheat, where I show that it wasn't a random act here and a random act there. This was a plan for how to loot the government, to enrich people, I lay out in very frightening and stark detail, submarine American national security by attacking friends when it was profitable, attack America's allies and friends, and give aid and comfort to countries that are hostile to or threatening to American national security interests. Jared Kushner did this, which I documented very clearly. And then you had two cabinet officers. There were a whole bunch of them, but I focus on two. Elaine Chao, the wife of Senator Mitch McConnell, who turned the Transportation Department into the marketing arm of her father's company, which owns 53 ocean-going ships that move things like iron ore and wheat between America, Brazil, Canada, and China. That's his business. And interestingly, with one notable exception of a TV interview, Elaine Chao only talked to communist newspaper reporters connected to the government in Beijing. And she, in writing, ordered the currying of favor with these people and had the government doing all sorts of personal favors for her father. If you're wealthy enough to own 53 ships, you're pretty rich. And she was recommended for prosecution by the inspector general. That hasn't happened. Wilbur Ross, the commerce secretary, who I've known almost as long as I've known Donald, not nearly as well, but I've known him. He was up to his eyeballs in Russian money laundering banking. He was vice chairman of the Bank of Cyprus, where there's a large Russian expatriate, and in many cases, criminal colony. The other vice chairman of that bank was an appointee of Vladimir Putin, and the head of the bank was the disgraced former head of Deutsche Bank, which is the world's premier bank for laundering crooked Russian money.
Where Justice Kennedy's son worked and handled Donald Trump's finances. And then Kennedy retired so they could put, was it Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court?
I think that seat went to Kavanaugh. It was, because Ruth Bader Ginsburg was Amy Coney Barrett. And so, you know, the 44 presidents before Donald Trump, you can like or dislike them. You know, you might like Richard Nixon, you might hate him, but not one of those presidents saw the White House as their personal fief to get rich and reward friends and undermine American interests. Chester Arthur, who was vice president, and the president died about 30 days into office, so he became president unexpectedly. He was a creature of Tammany Hall, the corrupt New York City political machine. And when he got into the White House, a bunch of Tammany Hall guys went down to Washington, walked into the White House, you know, licking their chops over how they were going to get rich. And Chester Arthur said, "Gentlemen, I'm now the president of the United States. I hold an office of public trust. I don't do that stuff anymore. Leave the White House and never darken the door of the White House again." And from him, we got the Pendleton Civil Service Act and other anti-corruption laws. Nobody but Donald Trump behaved the way he did. And so what I, in The Big Cheat, which is the third installment of my Trump trilogy, there was The Making of Donald Trump, where I told about his unbelievably deep entanglement with a major international drug lord, all from the public record, by the way. I don't use unnamed sources. Everything is public record, except my direct interviews with Donald, and almost all of those I wrote about at the time I had the interviews with him. So that's The Making of Donald Trump, and it has a lot about his criminal behavior. And then It's Even Worse Than You Think was about how they went about in the first year of the administration doing what they promised to do, which was to destroy the federal government. That's what Steve Bannon was saying when he said, "We're going to deconstruct the administrative state." That's just fancy language for "we're going to destroy the federal government." And then in The Big Cheat, which just came out, what I show is the profiteering. And, you know, all organizations take their leadership from the top. If you have a culture at the top of propriety, you tend to have a company or an administration that is full of propriety. If you have a leader at the top who's in there money grubbing and breaking the law, that's the kind of people you attract, and they take their cue from the top. And so this was endemic throughout the Trump administration, but it would be impossible to know the full scope of it and to make sense of it all unless, like me, you're crazy enough to subscribe to about 20 newspapers, have a research assistant, dig through tons of public records. There's like 40 pages of source notes in the back of my book, because I don't want people to in any way think it's me telling you this. It's the public record that I've put together telling you all of this. It's all thoroughly documented.
David, for the listeners, how involved are the Russians with him, still with him? I know forever he's been a Russian laundromat with his real estate. He's been to Russia. Is he basically a Putin asset? Is that an overreach? Because he sure acts like one.
Donald was for sure a Putin asset. And if he gets into the White House, he will be again. When Trump Tower opened, a Russian bought 5 apartments in it and paid cash. And Donald was so stunned by this that he went to the closing and met the guy. Trump Tower, at the time it went up, it technically opened in the last month of 1983, but it was 1984. Trump Tower was one of only 2 luxury residential buildings in Manhattan that would sell to anybody. The other was Olympia Tower, owned by the Onassis family, as in Jackie Kennedy Onassis. So in most buildings in New York, if they were fancy, you had to go before a co-op board or a condo owner, and you had to show your bona fides. You had to undergo a law enforcement background check, et cetera. And people were rejected for all sorts of reasons, most often the color of their skin or their religion, but also unsavory backgrounds or unsavory businesses. I mean, if you were the owner of a porno empire, you wouldn't get into any decent building in New York. Donald didn't vet his buyers. And that allowed him to charge a premium price. The line I've used is that if you wanted to buy your apartment in the name of Snow Inc., Donald didn't ask if that meant you owned a ski lodge in Aspen or were a cocaine trafficker. And so he got these enormously high prices. And in 1987, Donald took an all-expenses-paid tour of Russia. the old Soviet saw Donald as a potentially valuable resource, and they courted him. And governments do this all the time. I mean, we court people, the United States government courts people of various kinds who we think can be valuable. Most of them turn out not to be, but every now and then you hit a grand slam home run, and Donald was like, you know, three grand slam home runs in a row to the Kremlin. And remember, at Helsinki in 2018, Donald said publicly, I don't trust the 17 American intelligence agencies, but I trust Vladimir Putin and I take him at his word. And he went and met with him twice with no staff. Well, there was a translator in one of the meetings, and he took the woman's notes and tore them up, which, by the way, is itself a federal crime. And Putin controls state television in Russia. And state television in Russia, while Trump was still in office, ran on one of its most popular shows a segment where they called Donald Putin's puppet. Now, all of those people are still on the air, the talent and the producers and the other staff you don't see on camera, they're all still there, which screams that this was perfectly acceptable to Putin and may have even been ordered by him for all we know, but it certainly was not taken as an offense by Putin. We're not going to hear as much as our government knows, because in matters of national security, often you don't prosecute people. It's more important to keep pursuing them and seeing how they behave and watching what they do. And prosecuting them because of our rules about discovery can lead to the disclosure of American assets. We also know that in May of 2017, just a few months after Donald became president, he invited Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, a trained spy master, and Sergei Kislyak, the longtime Russian ambassador to the U.S., to the Oval Office, along with a quote-unquote news photographer from TASS, the government-owned news agency. And God only knows what the guy had in his gadget bag in terms of intelligence collecting material. The White House didn't tell anybody about this meeting. The Russians did. The Russians released photographs and a communique about it. And they revealed that Donald Trump gave them the most deeply guarded intelligence secrets we have, what are called sources and methods. You know, how'd you get this information and who'd you get it from? And immediately around the world, intelligence services started telling journalists and high-level policy people, we don't trust the U.S. anymore. We're going to be very guarded about what we tell the United States, because they give sources and methods. You know, if we have a spy in the Kremlin or a friendly business person who's helping us, they could get killed and our information could be cut off. And by the way, not long after that, a person who is believed to have been the most valuable American security asset inside the Kremlin, that is from the point of view of the Russians, a traitor, with cameras rolling, men in suits came into the room, threw a bag over his head, carried him out of the room, and he's never been heard from again. I think it's reasonable to assume that Donald gave the Russians information that allowed them to identify a mole of ours and certainly incarcerate and in all likelihood kill that person. This is traitorous conduct. This is conduct that is quite appropriately punished under our laws by execution.
I remember the Israelis freaked out too, because he gave away a bunch of their secrets to the Russians.
It was Israeli sources and methods that he gave away. But you know, if you're the Dutch, the Australians, the British, the French, all have very good intelligence services. And it was clear from news reports in those countries that they were freaking out about this. You know, it's one of the things that happened that goes to the looting of all this money. And that is Jared Kushner, when Donald Trump was running for president, was facing financial ruin because he had bought a building, 666 Fifth Avenue in New York, just down the street from Trump Tower. And he wildly overpaid for it. 3 years after he bought it, which was just before the Great Recession began, it was worth perhaps as little as a third of what he paid for it. And so he went to the government of Qatar and sought an $800 million loan to bail him out. Now, Qatar is where we have our most important military base in the Middle East. The Qataris are clearly our friends. They are the family owns the Al Jazeera news service that has opened up to people in the Middle East things other than official government news. And both the Saudis and the Emiratis are enemies of the Qataris because those two countries are run by dictatorships so brutal that about 5 years ago, the Saudi government beheaded 39 men, many of them imams or clerics, for, I kid you not, the crime of praying for a better government. They murdered them for praying for, this is the same government that killed the Washington Post columnist, Jamal Khashoggi. And so Ivanka Trump's husband, Jared Kushner, asked the Qataris for this $800 million loan. And the Qataris basically say, you know, we're really, really rich, but we're not really, really stupid. And no, we're not going to loan you the money. And what immediately follows is Donald Trump begins attacking the Qataris, saying that they're financing terrorists. And he goes to Saudi Arabia on his first foreign trip. And he meets with the Saudis and the Emiratis and their other allies and continues his attacks on the Qataris, including when there was an economic blockade of Qatar as the Saudis in particular tried to undo that regime and take away this thorn in their side. Well, guess what? Jared Kushner got bailed out. He got bailed out by Saudis and Emiratis. And now he's created an investment fund in the U.S. And right as soon as he was out of the White House, well, actually, before he left the White House, he made another tour of the Middle East. And then right after the Trump was out of the White House, he went back to the Middle East. And he's apparently raised at least $3 billion for him to manage on behalf of the Saudis. This is submarining American national security for personal gain. And why Merrick Garland hasn't had prosecutors all over this is beyond me, because it's totally inappropriate. And Malcolm Nance, who's done a lot of work on national security, worked in that field for many years, he asserts that the number one requester of confidential intelligence files on the Middle East in the White House was not the national security staff, of which there's a number of people, but Jared personally. But again, concern about disclosing things may be hindering prosecuting him, even though I think that there's plenty of information there to put together a grand jury and pursue Jared Kushner for submarining American intelligence for his personal gain.
Got so well laid out. And Garland is a member of the Federalist Society, so I have my suspicions. And his inactivity has only fueled those suspicions.
Merrick Garland is a guy whose reputation is the same as essentially Robert Mueller's, except Garland was not a valorous military officer in combat in Vietnam. And it's the only real difference between them. He's an absolute straight arrow Boy Scout. And the problem with straight arrow Boy Scouts in the culture of Washington is this is your culture around you. These are the people who you live with. It's a relatively small place. Every place gets small eventually, even, you know, Manhattan society. And so he doesn't have the perspective of an attorney general who might've been brought in from California or Oregon or Illinois, whose whole culture and life and future for his grown children depends on where you stand in that culture. And at the moment, you know, we need somebody who follows proper procedure fully, but we don't need a Boy Scout. We need someone who is a reformer in the Attorney General's office and who is going to see to it that we don't just go after the easy to convict idiots who tried to overthrow the government, but goes after the plotters behind it and whoever put up the money, because there had to be a lot of money behind this too.
Yeah, I would love to see someone like Attorney General James. She's fierce, and she is coming for him, but in a different arena.
Yeah, she's doing it civilly. She's doing it civilly because the New York State Attorney General, who is elected, only has inherent civil authority. She can acquire criminal authority in some circumstances, but her inherent authority is civil.
Where do the Koch brothers fit in all this evil?
That was a chapter in my book about the third Koch brother. The two best-known Koch brothers, one of whom has since died, don't like Donald Trump one bit. They are extreme libertarians, but they're also principled. That is, they walk their talk about what they believe. They're not intellectually corrupt. Their next richest brother, who's only worth $4 billion, or less than a tenth of what each of the other two are worth, lives one door away from Mar-a-Lago. There's one house in between Mar-a-Lago and William Koch's mansion. William Koch, a member of Mar-a-Lago, came out early for Donald Trump. He held a big fundraiser for him at his compound in Massachusetts, Cape Cod. It cost $250,000 to attend, and the place was packed. Well, we did a five-part series that I at DC Report, the news organization I run, DC Report Singular, about how he collects about $200 million a year and pays no income taxes through what I think is a flat-out scam. And for listeners who don't know this, I am renowned around the world as a tax expert. I've lectured on taxes on every continent except Antarctica and gotten two presidents to change their tax policies just by reporting the facts they weren't, I actually think they didn't know about. It turns out I have documentary proof that William Koch, Trump's neighbor, was under criminal investigation for not paying income taxes on his profits from his business, something called pet coke or petroleum coke. That's a really nasty, dirty fuel. He was claiming his profits were all earned in the Bahamas, where he rented a 1,200 square foot retail front in a shopping center and had three people of the hundreds who worked for him. And just very shortly after Donald Trump took office, weeks after he took office, the IRS dropped the criminal investigation of William Koch. William Koch's advisor, whom I dealt with, had no complaints about the story that I told at DC Report, and I haven't heard a word about the book. But nobody else has reported on it because he has a reputation for suing people. And I've tried to persuade CNN, MSNBC, The New York Times, that, and others, he sues people who fraudulently cheat him. There was a guy who sold him what he said was 200-year-old, very valuable wine, and it was a fraud. And he spent far more than the amount he was ripped off for, saying like 2.5 times as much, suing the guy. But I said, he's never going to sue you over this, because it doesn't follow his libertarian principles of free speech. If he has a factual error, he'll tell you about it to correct, but he's not going to sue you. And in fact, they have no complaints about the facts I have. So think about this. Here's a man who has gotten well more than $1 billion of money from a really blatant tax scam, who at least ought to have to pay his taxes, and in my view, deserves prison time. But because his neighbor and friend is in the White House, the IRS drops the investigation. And I don't think Donald Trump, by the way, ever made a phone call to the IRS. The whistleblower who through whom I got 1,000 pages of the company's internal documents, that's why we call them the Koch papers, is pretty persuaded that Trump must have called the IRS. My view, having written about the IRS for decades, is no, they're a bunch of smart bureaucrats who just looked at this case and said, you know, we got other cases. Let's go pursue those. We don't need to pick a fight with the president of the United States over his buddy. And that kind of corruption, compare that to Jimmy Carter put his peanut warehouse into a trust because people said, well, it would be corrupt for him to own it. I mean, this is a two-bit nothing business. It made him a moderately wealthy, you know, man in a farming community, but it was a nothing business. Barack Obama put all of his money, and he'd made considerable money before he got to the White House because of his book sales and things. He put his money into, I think it was all treasuries. That's what George Bush mostly did, treasuries and mutual funds, which is appropriate. Donald Trump put his business into what I call the Eyes Wide Open Blind Trust. And I show how less than an hour after Trump took the oath of office, on his way to the White House from the Capitol, the motorcade stopped on Pennsylvania Avenue, Constitution Avenue or Pennsylvania Avenue, whichever it is. And the family got out and spent 2 minutes walking around on the asphalt. What not one of the TV stations and no major newspaper reported the next day, in fact, I can't find anybody who reported it except me, was that they stopped in front of the Trump Washington Hotel. And so if you were a lobbyist seeking favors from this administration, which means you're a very keen observer of things like this, if you're a foreign diplomat, if you are a foreign military attaché, if you are a favor seeker for the commercial interests of some foreign government, you understood exactly what was happening here. This was a signal. If you want a favor from Donald Trump, you will pay tribute. And you better pay tribute in a way that Donald is aware of. Well, suddenly the government of Kuwait, which holds an annual, quote, Freedom Day celebration at another hotel, and which has only occurred since we threw Saddam Hussein out of their country and restored them to power, they moved their party to Trump's hotel. The American head of the T-Mobile cell phone company, who was trying to get a merger with Sprint, a merger the Obama administration denied as anti-competitive, makes a big public show of repeatedly staying at the Trump Hotel and having his picture taken and tweeting about it and making sure he's seen with other people, and he gets his $26 billion deal approved. And there was a back end to that deal that involved approving a super dangerous way to transport oil, Bakken shale oil, which has a terrible tendency to explode, through densely populated areas, including part of the city of Philadelphia at 40 or 50 miles an hour. And we wrote about these as these were considered by railroad safety experts to be bomb trains, who pointed out if one of them went off, the explosive force would be similar to the bomb we dropped on Hiroshima in 1945. And we could expect thousands of people to die. Well, you know, Trump administration, that's fine with us. We don't mind. Besides, it's going through a mostly minority neighborhood. So what I do in this, in The Big Cheat, is I bring together all of these things that were loose threads. You may have heard of this. You may never have heard of that one. But I show by putting them, by weaving them into a tapestry, that they were all part of a fundamental plan, of a fundamental way of approaching things, which is, oh, now we're in the White House. We're the anti-Chester Arthur. We're here to loot, pillage, and plunder. And unfortunately, a lot of the Washington press corps is made up of politics reporters, not investigative reporters. There was some excellent work, particularly by David Fahrenthold at the Washington Post, but a great deal of what went on has still never been reported on. If I reported on every single thing I know about, I'd have a 2,000-page book that would just overwhelm you. So I picked those stories and put them into 18 little vignette chapters that illustrate the determination of the people around Trump. Now, fortunately for us, Trump is a lousy manager. He is very mercurial, and he personally didn't benefit nearly as much as he could have. And if he gets back in the White House, as I'm sure he will have, because he'll become ruthless at that point. But people around him, like Jared Kushner, who is a sharp cookie and has all of Donald's amoral instincts, people like the Commerce Secretary and former vulture capitalist who Donald has dealt with for years, they knew what they were doing, they were focused, and they really set out to line their pockets and take care of their business interests. We had a Commerce Secretary who was in business with Russian liquefied natural gas shipping company and hid that, Wilbur Ross. I mean, Wilbur Ross is a man with just a horrible reputation in business. And he's literally in business with a Russian company involved in shipping natural gas, liquefied natural gas, while he is the Commerce Secretary of the United States. I cannot think of a more improper relationship for a Commerce Secretary.
Yeah, and Tom Barrack, too, is another one of those characters in there. There is a bunch of vultures David, did you ever see the irony or just step back and look at the fact that the guy is the world's greatest con man, world's greatest grifter, has seen billions pass through his hands, but no matter what happens, he seems to always be broke, cannot hold on to a penny.
Right. Money just, if you have ill-got money, it can just flow through your hands. Donald and I were walking together on the boardwalk one day in Atlantic City in 1990, and I said, hey, Donald, how much you worth? He goes, $3 billion. And I said, I don't believe you. He stops dead. He turns to me and says, who's your editor? And I said, oh, let me give you his name and his direct phone line. I was at the Philadelphia Inquirer at the time. And then he says to me, why don't you think I'm worth $3 billion? And I said, well, you know, Donald, I'm a mere newspaper reporter with 8 kids. And I pay all my bills on time. And I've been interviewing dozens of vendors and contractors who work for you who aren't getting paid and haven't been paid, some of them, for months. And he goes, yeah. And I said, well, if you really were worth $3 billion, you could either borrow the money to pay them, or you could sell or encumber some asset to get the cash to pay these bills. And the fact that you can't tells me that you don't, it's all smoke and mirrors. Well, later that day, Donald flew on his helicopter, the then called the Ivana after his first wife, back to Manhattan. And he was interviewed by a television reporter. Remember, he told me he was worth $3 billion. He told the TV reporter he was worth $5 billion. That was the one of the very early indications to me that the guy just makes the stuff up, and yet people believe him. They want to believe him. And that's how con artists work. The way con artists work is they persuade you to believe that which cannot possibly be true. I've got the title here to the Brooklyn Bridge. Buy this stock and it'll make you a gazillionaire. Well, if it'll make you a gazillionaire, why would you sell it to me? Well, because, you know, I'm your friend and there's so much here I want to share with people. And this is an opportunity and we'll do other business deals. But Donald's always been smoke and mirrors. And by the way, it came out in 1990. I broke the story in April that year that he was not a billionaire. He went around attacking me and saying I was a liar until about 4 months later, when he had to put into the public record his banker's assessment of his net worth. And the lead we ran in the Philadelphia Inquirer, it was stripped above the masthead at the top of the paper. I mean, that's, you almost never get that kind of play as a reporter. The lead was, I'm doing this from memory, you are probably worth more than Donald Trump, because Trump was worth negative $300 million.
That's why nobody would lend him money except the oligarchs under the table.
That's well, the Russians. I mean, he got these loans from Deutsche Bank, notorious for Russian money laundering. And there's something banks do, but particularly Deutsche Bank, called a back-to-back loan. So a Russian criminal, one of the Russian billionaires, could go to Deutsche Bank and say, we want you to make this loan to Donald Trump of $100 million. I will deposit $100 million with you or give you a letter of credit for $100 million. And if he doesn't pay off, you can collect from me. So it would appear to the public that Deutsche Bank just made a loan to Donald. Only regulators with audit authority, and assuming Deutsche Bank's books are honest, which I don't assume for a second, would know that, in fact, no, this was a loan backed by the Kremlin.
And didn't the Deutsche Bank forgive like a couple $100 million loan?
Deutsche Bank has forgiven him enormous amounts of loans, and people in the compliance departments and risk departments who said you shouldn't do business with this guy were shoved aside, and they continued to do business with him, which is another clear badge that there is something criminal, something fraudulent going on that we are not seeing because of, frankly, in America, we have very weak white-collar crime laws. Now, lots of defenses in them, lots of opportunities to fudge facts and hide things because of the way our system works. I've argued that Deutsche Bank, which also marketed some of the big tax shelters that I exposed when I was the New York Times tax reporter, from the perspective of the American government and the American people, is a criminal organization whose banking license should be revoked, because you don't have a right to have a bank. It's a privilege granted by the government, and that we should kick them out of our country. I also am aware that if Deutsche Bank is as corrupt as I and other journalists who've looked deeply into this believe, it also probably is a fabulous source of intelligence. And as I mentioned earlier, the intelligence services often don't want somebody prosecuted because they want to keep following what they're doing and what they're up to and the threats posed to the United States, not put somebody in jail.
I have a friend who is a bank fraud examiner at the highest level, and he said similar things. They pour over everything. So you're on the point. You were around him. Is there any charm to this guy? Why does he have a cult-like following?
Well, Donald can, I've been the subject of both romance and verbal assault by Donald. Donald can be the most charming, has his attention focused on you guy when he wants to be, at least for a brief period of time. But on just a comma he didn't like or a pause, he can turn ferocious and scream and yell at you. He's called me at home over the years so many times to scream and yell at me and tell me he's going to. And I always say very calmly to him, as I'm assuming he's recording this and he might put the recording out in public, I always say, well, Donald, if you think you have a case, you should sue me and we'll hash this out in court. And of course, Donald knows that everything I write about him, I have solidly bolted down. And there's nothing he can sue me over. There are lots of things I know that I haven't written about because I can't prove them. And they're really awful, worse things. But if I can't prove them, I don't write about them and I don't talk about them. But I mean, he's afraid of me. He recently said he wanted somebody to debate anybody. He said he would debate anybody about the stolen election. So I posted on Twitter and contacted various journalists and said, I'll debate him. He can pick the forum. And Donald said it'd be a ratings thing and he'd make a lot of money. And I said, and I will transparently give whatever money I get to charity. And then Donald issued a revised statement saying, he would only debate a credible person.
No way we get. I would pay to see that with you. I'd pay. I would pay good money.
He's afraid of me, Paul. He's very afraid of me.
Hey, I know I got to let you go, and I appreciate your reporting. And sadly, you lost your younger brother recently. I wondered if we could mention him, and we could dedicate this beautiful show and your work to that loss of yours. And it's never nice to lose anyone, no matter how long they've lived, and especially someone younger. And you're really a trooper to come on here.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thank you, Paul. My brother, Eric Johnston, and I grew up in Santa Cruz, California. We were as different as can be. My brother was a manual laborer, but he cared a great deal about people who were worse off than he was. He, like me, didn't have much tolerance for racial, religious, gender bigotry. And he lived in a manufactured home in the country, in the woods, in rural Oregon near the coast. They got a huge snow dump of the kind they never get there. And I said, well, you should go and at least rake off the patio covering because it's not built for a lot of weight. And he went out and did that. And knowing Eric, instead of doing a little bit of it and then walking away or minimizing the effort, he went whole hog on it, and that night he dialed 911, said he was in distress, and by the time the EMTs arrived, this little dirt road he lived on, he was gone. And it's, it's always sad when we lose a member of a family. We should also remember that we live in a society where all of us do better when all of us care about one another and all of us treat one another with regard. We don't, as Donald Trump teaches, treat people as inferior if we don't like the color of their skin, their gender, their looks, their religion. But we treat everyone as equal people, not necessarily equal in our conduct, but having equality among human beings and then judge them on their conduct.
Kind of the core teachings of every deep spiritual tradition.
Yeah.
At least he lived his life and was out there in the country, at least to the end, because it sounds like he was a great nature guy.
Great baseball guy. He was, when he was a kid in Santa Cruz, he was very well known in town for his pitching ability and all the home runs he would hit. And unlike me, I'm a klutz. He was an athlete. I'm an intellectual. He's a manual laborer. But, we grow up, we're different people. As the father of eight children, I can tell you that When they were very little, I thought my kids were all alike. And when they grew up, I realized, oh my goodness, how different they are.
It's a miracle how we come in and go out, and also the uniqueness of it all. God, and you got, I thought your reporting was brave. 8 kids. We got to figure out some sort of What Matters Most award for you. That's a whole level of courage we haven't seen in these parts.
Well, thank you, Paul. And I do hope people don't let Trump fatigue keep them from reading The Big Cheat, because it will really help people understand what a threat he was to our well-being, and how, you know, to Donald, any money you have, well, it's his money. He just hasn't gotten it from you yet. And that's which is the classic grifter approach to things. And people with DC report, we keep reporting things as they come out. The Biden administration has adopted some of the worst things that Trump did. We'll run a piece on January 10th about how there's a scheme afoot that started with the Trump organization to have Wall Street decide whether, when you're on Medicare, you get treatment, an adequate treatment, or they deny care and they get to keep 40% of the money they didn't spend on keeping you healthy. Hey, thank you very much, Paul. Take care.
You've been listening to the What Matters Most podcast, a 100% listener-supported program. If you feel inspired, please go to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/whatmattersmost and join our family. So until the next time, stay inspired and in the light.